Committee, and welcome everybody here today. Nice to see a crowd with us today. We've been missing that lately, so we wanted to schedule something that would bring some people in to spend their mornings with us, and glad you could join us. We'll start with a public hearing on House Bill 3632. Dick, if you could give us first the staff overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Richard Yates with Legislative Revenue. You have in the materials provided you a staff measure summary and also a revenue impact statement. Bill number 3632T, I'm not sure where the T came from, but we'll get that out of there.
Timber?
Maybe. What the House Bill 3632 does, it's, among other things, it changes the criteria for land acquisition by the Board of Forestry to emphasize timber harvest. It requires that the state forester to actively manage primarily for timber production and timber harvest. It requires rapid harvest of trees affected by the Swiss needle cast disease. Requires the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests to be managed in compliance with the Forest Practices Act and prohibits more restrictive standards. Requires the Board of Forestry to modify the Northwest State Forest Management Plan to comply with this act, and it takes effect January 1 of 2004.
Okay. Thank you, Dick. If we could just talk for a second about the revenue impact statement, I think in my interest in having this bill drafted was to look at the opportunities of taking greater advantage of the yield and the harvest in state forest lands for the benefit of the economy and the state while maintaining, of course, the environmental laws are in place right now under the Oregon Forest Practices Act, and I see that on the environmental or the revenue impact statement, we've got $90 million. That's direct revenue from harvest. Is that what that is?
That's correct.
And then in your comments below that, I think it's just worth pointing out to committee and to those who are gathered here, we've also got from this, based on the anticipated harvest, we're talking 3,600 jobs?
Yes.
$180 million. Is that a biennial number? $180 million in personal income?
Yes.
And 10.6 in personal and corporate? Oh, income tax revenue. That's
yes.
the tax revenue.
Okay. Yes.
So if you were to aggregate that with the direct tax revenue from the harvest, you're looking at about $100 million per biennium.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, that's worth talking about. Let's bring up then our opening panel, John Hampton, Dave Ivanhoff, and Ray Wilkerson. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Hampton. I'm the chairman of Hampton Affiliates, a family company here in Oregon since 1942. With me this morning are David Ivanhoff, who is the vice president of resources for Hampton Affiliates, and he will talk about the upside potential of what this bill can do to help contribute revenues in an environmentally responsible manner. And following that, Ray Wilkerson of Oregon Forest Industries Council. While all of Oregon is suffering from an economic malaise, the rural parts of the state are in more difficult straits than the urban parts due to the fact that in the decade of the 90s, the federal forests, which comprise 60% of the standing timber in the state of Oregon, have essentially been shut down from commercial forest management activity. A little research on the data demonstrates that there were in Oregon 288 mills in the forest industry in 1989. Whereas current number of mills has been reduced to 145. Many of these mills were privately owned family companies who simply could not stand the lack of federal timber. These mills are the sawmills, plywood plants, particle board plants, oriented strand board plants, pulp and paper mills, and other associated type operations that comprise our industry. In 1989, we employed 77,000 people in these 288 mills, while current employment has declined to 39,000 people. It's a rule of thumb that there are approximately the same number of contractors hauling our chips, hauling our logs, logging our standing timber, as there are employees in our manufacturing plants. So it's a little known fact that we are the largest manufacturing component in the state of Oregon, this forest industry, which is still struggling to survive under very difficult conditions due to a surplus of Canadian production being imported into the United States. Most state forest lands were deeded to the state by the counties in which the lands repose after four devastating fires beginning in 1933. Every year for 6 years thereafter, another major fire event occurred. A massive reforestation effort was undertaken after the counties deeded these lands over to the state to be reforested and managed for optimum timber and revenue outputs for their benefit in the future. For several years, the State Department of Forestry has been holding extensive hearings and deliberations over the kind of forest plan that would be appropriate on these lands now that they're ready to fulfill their promise of the initial investments in reforestation. Included in the Board of Forestry's deliberations was that of a committee of three people who explored whether or not there should be a change in the purpose of the lands rule. A recommendation was made and adopted by the Board of Forestry that no longer should timber and revenues to the counties be a dominant priority. The Board therefore has developed a plan that has increased emphasis on other attributes at the expense of optimum timber and revenue outputs. The Department of Forestry receives approximately 36% of the revenues from the timber sales, with the counties receiving the remaining 64%. Our Willamina and Tillamook mills are among the largest mills in the industry. That's a product of our family's commitment to reinvest in high technology equipment to increase our productivity, to increase our recovery, to reduce our costs, and to be competitive in what has become truly a global market. Prices are currently depressed due to the imports from Canada, where provincial government policy is to provide very low-cost timber because they must export. The Dominion of Canada only has about 20 million people, but they have a capacity that's at least as large as what our capacity is here on the West Coast. In spite of the fact that they are paying duty of some 27% on the value of the timber, plus some dumping duties in addition on those that are selling their lumber below cost, we have the problem here of competing with them with very low-cost timber because that's government policy there. They are interested in maintaining employment and community stability as a primary focus, not to get increased revenues from their timber, whereas the cost of our product, our lumber cost, 75% of that comes from the cost of our logs delivered to our pond. 3 years ago, partly in anticipation of increased timber supplies from the state timberlands in Tillamook, Clatsop, and Washington counties, our company invested $10.5 million in a complete overhaul of our very efficient small log mill at Willamina. In addition, we have spent several million dollars upgrading and improving the efficiency of our Tillamook plant with the inclusion of the state-of-the-art scanning and computing systems that provide solutions on the logs for higher yield and significant increases in output. And we have a plan to continue to make these kinds of investments on an ongoing basis. We consistently plow back into our plants at least as much as our depreciation, and in most cases more than that, so that we can keep on the cutting edge of technology. There is no alternative employment in Willamina and Tillamook for the kind of family wages that these operations support. We employ 522 people in these two mills with a total annual payroll of $29 million, including fringe benefits. Operating supplies and repair parts bring Oregon merchants almost $9 million a year in business. As mentioned earlier, the contractors that we employ produce about the same number of family jobs and payrolls as we have in our sawmills. So it is a very powerful economic stimulus that we provide to these two rural communities. Oregon stands at the brink of the abyss in terms of generating sufficient revenues to provide critical services in health care, public safety, and education. And it seems inappropriate that state timberlands underproduce their potential. The implementation plans currently outstanding do not begin to approach their potential. In addition to providing revenues to support the public's needs, having that raw material available will increase our industry's competitiveness in global markets. In many cases, we're currently hauling logs extraordinary distances. Some of the timber sales that our company buys from the State of Washington Department of Natural Resources are hauled to Willamette and Tillamook for processing due to inadequate local timber supplies. A number of other operators are bringing logs to Oregon from Idaho, Montana, and from as far away as New Mexico and Nevada and Arizona. I should emphasize that we are not interested in profitability in the short term. We have consistently reinvested at a minimum this annual depreciation. We're among the most competitive and efficient mills in the industry today. The family has committed itself to maintain these businesses and has grown them while almost half the industry has gone out of business. We're currently the second largest lumber manufacturer in the Pacific Northwest, second only to the Weyerhaeuser Company in lumber production. We've put our capital into this high-risk business because we want to continue the business for the benefit of our employees and our family. This is why we're so keenly interested in having the appropriate focus on the highest possible sustainable harvest from these state lands while still providing appropriate environmental protection, assuring diversity of wildlife, water quality, streamside protection that produce favorable results for our fish. And I'm sure you will remember that last year we had record numbers of returning coho demonstrating that the Forest Practice Act is in fact working. We're not suggesting that the premise of the basic plan be changed at this time, but we're convinced, as Dave Ivanoff's testimony will demonstrate, that the implementation plans developed by the Department of Forestry are woefully inadequate compared to their potential. Dave Ivanoff will now give you an explanation of the revenue increases available with changes in the Department of Forestry's approach to implementation plans, followed by Ray Wilkerson, who will speak to the differences between Northwest Forest Management Plan and the Forest Practices Act. So, Dave?
All right, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Hampton, or should we go ahead and do the panel and then take questions?
I have a number of questions, but I think I'd rather hear from the rest
of
the panel.
You bet. Let's do it. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Ivanoff.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dave Ivanoff. I'm the Vice President of Resources for Hampton Affiliates, and in that capacity, I'm the person responsible for the procurement of the raw material needed to support our company sawmills in Willamina and Tillamook. I think, first of all, it would be helpful to describe the current state of the forest management practices or plan out there and how it has evolved to where it is today. The forest planning effort began on this land base in 1994. I, along with very many others from different perspectives, participated in a long, arduous effort trying to influence the final outcome of the plan. Countless public meetings, testimony in front of the Board of Forestry and in front of the Department of Forestry was part of the process by well-intentioned people of many different perspectives. The plan was ultimately approved by the Board of Forestry in January of 2001, and part of the intent strategy is to implement the plan according to the model assumptions and policy choices used in a model that was developed on behalf of the Department of Forestry by Dr. John Sessions of Oregon State University. Dr. Sessions is a world-renowned expert in forest modeling and has a high degree of respect throughout the industry and in the forestry profession. In Dr. Sessions' model that ultimately became the benchmark around which the forest management plan was approved, he predicted off the three North Coast districts, Astoria, Forest Grove, and Tillamook, that the first decadal harvest levels would be 279 million board feet a year. Now, again, I want to emphasize that the forest management plan that the board approved in January of 2001 was a compromise. Under an intensive even-age management that is practiced by other landowners, both large and small, the outputs from this 500,000 acres would be significantly higher than 279 million feet. However, it was a compromise that developed over a 7 or 8 year planning effort, and I accepted that along with OFIC and other members of the forest products industry. When the department approved the forest management plan, there was a real sense of satisfaction that through this long process, we had come to a compromise that everybody could hopefully live with. Nobody was totally satisfied, but at least everybody was had participated in the process. Well, to our absolute dismay, in June of 2001, the department published the implementation plans, and those outputs on this same land base were about 145 million feet a year. Not only was this over 130 million feet short of what Dr. Sessions modeled, it was actually less than what the department had sold in the previous couple of years. I was outraged when I found out what the outputs were likely going to be under this, and so with a lot of help from the counties, the department has seen fit to adjust the implementation strategies to now predict a mid-range of outputs of about 179 million feet a year. That's still 100 million feet short of what Dr. Sessions modeled. I would like now, if I could, to turn your attention to the spreadsheet that was passed out. It has a number of different boxes on it. I would like to draw your attention to the middle box, issues relative to the Northwest Forest Management Plan. Under item one, this is just a tabular illustration of the outputs under the final implementation plans that were approved in March of this year by the acting state forester. In the highlighted yellow box, you can see the mid-range outputs is 179 million feet per year. If you go down to number two, this is the projected annual revenue loss as a result of the department not fully implementing the plan according to Dr. Sessions' model. And again, the difference between 279 million feet and 179 million feet is 100 million feet a year at an average stumpage rate of $300 a thousand. That's $30 million a year or $60 million per biennium. Now, part of the discussion that we had, obviously, after the initial implementation plans were published is, why is there such a disconnect between Dr. Sessions' numbers and what the department plans to implement on the ground? And indeed, Dr. Sessions' model has been impugned as being flawed, and there's also a concern about the inventory that exists out on the land base and that the assumptions embodied in the model were faulty. I can only say, as a professional forester with over 30 years experience managing both east side and west side forest lands, Dr. Sessions' numbers are reasonable. Under item three, this is a rule of thumb to estimate the amount of growth that's currently transpiring on that 500,000 acres. There's various ways of estimating forest growth, but under item A, a land base of this age class, of this site quality, should be growing about 1,100 board feet per acre per year. I've discounted that number by 20% for the riparian areas that would be off limits, which again is overly conservative. Current forest practice regulations probably impact riparian areas to the tune of 6 to 8%, but I've used a 20% discount. And then in addition, I've discounted the product by another 25% to account for that portion of the land base that's affected by Swiss needle cast. That's the acronym SNC there. You can see the result of that exercise shows a growth rate of 333 million feet a year. If you take the low end of the inventory range that exists out there of 9 billion feet under item B there, again taking 5% growth rate, that's what that forest should be doing at these age classes, discounting it for the Swiss needle cast impact, that would predict a growth rate of 338 million feet rounded. And then if you take the upper end of the range of inventory that is potentially out there, that's the 13 billion foot number under C, you can see that growth rate, again discounted for needle cast, would show 488 million. The average of those three numbers is 385 million feet a year. Now, it's coincidental in Department of Forestry testimony on April 11th in the Senate Natural Resource Committee, under the timber supply assessment that the department did, internal Department of Forestry memoranda suggests that this land base in this decade would be producing 370 million feet a year on a sustainable basis under intensive even age management. That's very close to the 385 million foot a year number that I'm using just to predict growth. So based on that, on those statistics, in my experience and others that you'll likely hear from today, Dr. Sessions' number of 279 million feet a year is totally consistent with what is reasonable out on the landscape. I would like to turn your attention now to the basic premise of House Bill 3632 and the revenue impact of that bill. Under Item A, the upper end of that the department has acknowledged that these lands are capable of producing today is about 350 million feet a year. I've given the department credit for the fact that in this annual operation plan for this fiscal year, instead of 179 million feet, which is the average, if you look up above, I've illustrated in the green highlighted area, 200 million feet. So I've used 200 million feet to be consistent with the revenue impact statement. There is 150 million feet of additional volume. Again, at the stumpage rate of $300 a thousand, that would generate a difference of $45 million a year or $90 million per biennium. And the $300 a thousand stumpage rate is totally consistent. In fiscal 2002, the timber sales sold on the Astoria, Forest Grove, and Tillamook districts averaged $302.52. If these lands were managed on a more traditional even-age management approach, logging costs would go down, stumpage rates would go up. So I think $300 a thousand is a conservative number, but nonetheless, I agree with the revenue impact state to that extent. It's my understanding that the original intent of this legislation was to include all of the lands embodied within the Northwest and Southwest Forest Management Plan, and that would include the Santiam District, the Western Oregon District, the Western Lane District, and the 18,000 acres in Southwest Oregon outside of the Elliott State Forest. That would add about another 130,000 acres to the 500,000 acres that's covered in the Astoria, Forest Grove, and Tillamook districts. In addition to the 150 million feet that would be derived from this change in management strategy on the North Coast districts, the inclusion of those other districts would add about 29 million feet of additional production per year, making the total incremental impact in volume on an annual basis 179 million. So if you look at item E in the very bottom of the last block there, I would forecast that just in stumpage receipts alone, not taking into account the jobs and the multiplier effect through the economy, this would amount to $107.4 million per biennium. If I could draw your attention to the very top box, the last bullet point in the red text, this is another point that I would like to make. In the state of Oregon, state lands comprise about 3% of the forested landscape. Forest lands under federal ownership are about 57% of the land, and the remaining ownership is held in tribal interests and large and small landowners. The point I would like to make here is that the federal lands comprise 57% of the land base, and they are largely managed for the benefit of old growth dependent species and other non-commodity values. The point is that under the Department of Forestry's strategy, about 50% of the land base will eventually be grown into older age classes. That would make a 1.5% incremental contribution to the habitat needs of old growth dependent species, but it's going to come at the cost of $107 million every 2 years. I really question whether or not the cost-benefit analysis would say that that's a good policy for the state. In summary, early on, the Department of Forestry planning staff, before any model outputs were generated, assured me that structure-based management would mirror the outputs of traditional even-age management in terms of timber outputs and revenue flow when those two attributes are combined together. One of the basic assumptions is that the eventual harvest of large diameter trees that are grown on extended rotations would bring a higher stumpage rate, and to the extent the shortfall in timber outputs would be offset with higher per unit cost for this larger diameter timber. The opposite is true. Larger diameter trees sell at a discount today to smaller diameter trees. The basic premise that structure-based management to the degree planned in this model would be equivalent to traditional even-age management is at question in my view. The aquatic and riparian strategies of the Forest Management Plan go far beyond those needed or specified under the Forest Practices Act. And as John alluded to, the record runs of coho salmon coming back. Without the scientific justification to essentially write off 20 to 25% of a land base with no harvest activity, in my view, is poor public policy at this time. I think I can only say from my standpoint, Oregon is on the verge of insolvency. This is a tremendously wonderful opportunity to help restore the rural and the current and urban economies in this state in an environmentally and sustainable manner. I believe legislative oversight is needed at this time to ensure that these lands are managed in a manner consistent with the intent of the original transfer from the counties. And I think we can employ the concept of structure-based management to that degree, but I support House Bill 3632 in that end. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Ivanoff. Maybe just before we go to Ray, if we could just stop and make sure that our glossary is all current and we're all working on the same terminology. If you could go back, you talk structure-based management. You refer to the Northwest Forest Management Plan. Just a couple of those terms and phrases so we know exactly what we're talking, what witnesses are talking about when they use those various phrases.
Structure-based management, Mr. Chair, structure-based management is a management strategy in which the Department of Forestry is attempting to create across the landscape a diversity of forest habitat conditions. The idea of structure-based management is there's going to be five different stand types. The oldest of the two will be in timber anywhere from 80 to 130 years in age. And they are going to try to replicate in that period of time the stand structure components of an old growth forest. And then there's other structures of intermediate ages down to reproduction. As far as the forest management plan goes, I'm speaking of the Northwest and Southwest Forest Management Plan that was approved by the Board of Forestry in January of 2001.
Okay. And the plan under the bill you refer to as the management practice or under the bill you refer to as
forest.
Yeah, well, that's the Forest Practices Act. Yeah.
The what I was trying to draw the distinction between is the forest management plan that's currently in place uses aquatic and riparian strategies that go far beyond the requirements for the Forest Practice Act calls for, and my point in that is that without the scientific justification to do so, that's what I'm calling into question at this time.
Okay. I just wanted to take a second to make sure everyone was up to speed on that. Representative Barnhart?
There's one other glossary type term.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that is intensive even age management. You used that term several times.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, intensive even age management is the more traditional approach for management of forest lands in the on the west side of the state, in which basically harvest activity can occur anywhere from age 50 to 70 under traditional even age management, where you are trying to maximize timber outputs and the economic to derive the highest possible net present value. Usually most forest landowners thin those stands at age 35 to 45, and then final harvest occurs 15 to 20 years thereafter.
Got to remember, we're the Revenue Committee and not the Natural Resources Committee, so we just want to make sure we get our terminology. Basically, then, I think for my own mind and committee, I think structure-based describes what is in place now with the Department of Forestry under their Northwest Forest Management Plan.
Yes, sir.
Intensive even-age management describes what would be in place under the bill governed by the Forest Practices Act.
Yes, sir.
Okay? So one refers to one to the other.
Okay, that's helpful,
and
too.
That replaces the other.
Yes, that's right. Intensive even-age management would replace structure-based management. Right. Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. Ray Wilkerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray Wilkerson of the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'll be brief. We represent private forest landowners, and as such, we actually have a diverse membership in the sense that some of them have manufacturing facilities and some do not. And those who do not are tree farmers who market their logs, much like the state does. And as a result, those members wouldn't necessarily benefit from this bill. The other half of our membership definitely would. So because of that diversity, our reason to be here today is to provide some information to the committee. I passed out a handout that basically describes some of the differences, which have been touched on already, between how the state's approaching managing these lands and how basically the private industry would if they owned them under the Forest Practices Act. And there's basically three differences. A couple of them have been mentioned. Before I mention those three, though, I'd also like to point out that, just for clarity, that these lands are not virgin, old-growth, ancient forests. This is basically a second-growth Douglas fir forest. They used to be private lands. They were logged over or burned over and then went back to the counties for tax foreclosures, either because of the conditions during the Depression or because of the fires. So there's nothing unique, ecologically unique, about these lands. There's a lot of economic value there, but in terms of ecology, they're no different than private lands in their current condition. Again, the handout I passed out does describe the three basic differences between the current plan, the state's following, and how private land is managed. Longer rotations have been mentioned. Basically, private landowners would harvest these trees on about a 50-year cycle. The state is looking at an 80 to 130-year cycle. That's an expensive decision. There's a way to calculate a financially optimal rotation age, and that's what private forest landowners do. It has to do with net present value and discount rates and time value of money. It's complicated, but it's pretty precise. And to the extent that you delay harvest past that financially optimal rotation age, it's expensive. And the more you delay, the more expensive it gets. That's one big difference. Another big difference is the state is attempting, there are listed species on these lands as well as on private lands in Western Oregon under the federal ESA. The spotted owl and marbled murrelet are the two primary ones, plus some fish species. As a result of that, the state is trying to negotiate what's called a habitat conservation plan with the federal regulatory agencies. This is something that they've spent a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of money trying to do. They don't have much to show for it yet. They're not required to do that. The federal law does not impose higher standards on state land than it does on private land. The responsibilities and obligations are the same. So they're making a choice to try to do this negotiation with the federal agencies. Similarly situated private landowners that have the same species issues have made a different choice. We are not, there is no multi-species habitat conservation plans on private land in Oregon. The state says they believe what they're doing is a good business decision, but it's questionable. I think that's questionable because if it was, we would be doing it and we're not. The third biggest difference is, and it's been alluded to earlier, is the protection zones that are overlaid on the state forest management plan that go far beyond the requirements of the Forest Practices Act. As an example, on stream buffers, the strip of trees you've got to leave next to a fish-bearing stream, under the Forest Practices Act that applies to private land, that width varies between 50 and 100 feet on each side of the tree stream, depending on the stream size. Under the state's plan, no matter how big or small the stream is, as long as it's got fish in it, the buffers are 170 feet wide on each side of the stream. To visualize that, think of a football field. And some of these small fish-bearing streams are very small, only 2 or 3 feet wide. So if you had a 2 or 3 foot wide stream on a football field running right down the 50-yard line, 170 feet on each side, you'd have trees clear into the end zone to protect that small 2 or 3 foot wide stream. That, in a lot of people's view, is an unnecessarily restrictive requirement, and you're leaving a lot of value.
And what yard line would you be down to under the Forest Practices Act?
Well, it would be, depending on the side of the stream, it would be either, instead of 170 feet, it would be either 50 or 100, be between 50 and 100 feet. So you'd have to divide that by three, and find the yard line. Anyway, I think our real interest, OFIC's real interest, in this legislation is on the latter point, the differences in the protection zones between what the state's doing and what the Forest Practices Act requires. We believe the Forest Practices Act is a good law that adequately protects the environment. It has been upgraded several times when new scientific evidence comes forward that shows that, you know, we need to do a little better to protect the environment. We think that it's doing that, and
If it isn't, someone needs to tell us what is wrong with it, and we will be happy to agree to fix it. If it is doing a good job of protecting the environment, then what? How does the state justify going beyond that and leaving the value behind that is reflected in the revenue impacts analysis of this bill? I don't think you can have it both ways. It's either, you know, we're all interested in doing the right thing ecologically and environmentally. The fact that the state is, through this stream buffer example and other places, is going way beyond what's required on private land, it reflects badly on us. There's an inference there that somehow we're doing something wrong and the state's making up for it. And we don't agree with that. If we are, tell us what it is and we'll do it different. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I think that's basically what describes the differences between the two approaches, which, as you've pointed out, has a significant financial consequence to it.
Mr. Evans?
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond, the last point you made relative to my personal position on the bill, my biggest problem with the forest management plan that the Board of Forestry approved are the implementation plans so far short of what the potential is. I do believe that through the passage of this bill, that the principles of structure-based management can still be maintained and be consistent with the intent of this bill. So I'd like to add that bit of clarification, if I could, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I think we have some questions. Representative Barnhart, you indicated you had a few.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to demonstrate my ignorance of the Forest Practices Act and probably a number of the other things
we're
talking about. And I ask your indulgence for that.
We'll all breathe a sigh of relief when you ask the questions that were in our mind.
Well, thank you. There's some other sections of this bill that I'd like to ask about, and I don't know whether this is the right panel to ask
it
or not. If not, you'll tell me, and I'll ask it of somebody else. One of the sections talks about converting to disease-resistant species from those that are subject to the Swiss needle cast disease. Can any of you talk about that issue a little bit?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Barnhart, the conversion to disease-resistant species in this area impacted by Swiss needle cast would be conversion to species like hemlock, Sitka spruce, western red cedar, and red alder, maple, etc., as opposed to Douglas fir, which is the host species for the needle cast problem.
Okay, and now the species you're describing are species which probably grew there before the first harvest, aren't they?
That's, Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, that's correct. A lot of the areas that were harvested after the fires tended to be Douglas fir. There's some concern that some of the trees may be off-site trees, not specifically suited to the coastal environment, the fog belt, if you will, and that could create the ideal conditions for the disease to be a problem. Transitioning those stands to species that are not hosts of that disease would take care of that problem and put that land in full productivity.
Okay. A different kind of question. One of the things that Mr. Wilkerson talked about was the precision with which it's possible to predict the time when you ought to harvest trees and what the growing cycle ought to be in terms of maximizing your return. I'm wondering if a part of that calculation includes the issue of a long-term utilization, and by that I mean centuries, of utilization of the land as a medium for growing timber. Is that factored into your calculation for the optimum time for harvesting trees, along with the other factors you mentioned, like the time value of money and so forth? Well, I don't know if he's the right one to answer that question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart, these timber stands that exist at the present time are a product of thousands of years of evolution. It's only in the last couple hundred years that this timber has been commercially harvested when civilization reached the West after Lewis and Clark arrived. The decision at which time to rotate by clear cutting or otherwise the current crop of trees does not take into consideration the elements about successive successive centuries. These soils are highly productive. We expect that they will be capable of continuing to produce commercial timber stands as long as civilization desires to do that. We do not expect that the soil resource will be destroyed over time. Nature continues to replenish the nutrients in the soil. The byproducts of logging are left to deteriorate and to add material back into the soil base. So that is not an overt decision about, you know, what would the desired future condition be 1,000 years from now. Is not one of those things in the forefront of our thinking when we decide to cut trees at age 50 or 60.
Well, I would assume that that aspect of sustainability, not only in terms of growth but in terms of productivity of the land itself, must be factored into the Forest Practices Act, because that certainly was a concern, I know, in terms of determining responsible forest practices on private land, that we weren't going to be depleting this land in 50 years or 100 years to a point that it wouldn't grow trees anymore. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I assume that
No, that is certainly correct, Mr. Chairman. In fact, Northwest Oregon is the ideal demonstration forest for the resiliency and the recovery potential of these highly productive timberlands. Loggers who first began logging here when civilization arrived absolutely created a war zone. It looked like somebody had just bombed Iraq. They were using splash dams. They were running their cats and logging equipment through the streams, tearing up the soil, and just leaving logs every which way. And there wasn't any sensible approach to forest management. That came later, as we learned about that through scientific exploration and development of logging techniques, to the point where we now have a very rigid Forest Practices Act. Some say the strongest Forest Practices Act in the United States. And so we believe that we are behaving in a very responsible way to protect those soils and the sustainability of our forest management.
Okay. Mr. Ivanov?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I would just like to follow up on your question and emphasize that forest managers, when making harvest decisions, are absolutely concerned about the ability to reforest the site on which harvest activity will take place, and to be aware of the environmental impacts of that harvest activity, and to the extent necessary to do so, will mitigate the environmental impacts to have the least impact on endangered species, etc. So it's not done just from the standpoint of harvesting when it's economically or biologically mature. That's not a decision alone. It's a whole myriad of issues that are taken into account.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I'd like to switch topics. If
you may.
Thank you. I think it was Mr. Hampton who mentioned Canada, and I'm wondering if you can tell us anything about their capacity to do to sustain the current level of cut over time. Are they going to be able to do that, or
They will certainly be able to do that for the foreseeable future. In fact, in addition to managing their lands on a sustainable basis, they have surplus volumes of timber available, particularly due to a major infestation of beetles in the northern interior. It's estimated that there is perhaps 3 billion to 4 billion feet of beetle-killed timber that is going to be on top of the existing sustainable harvest. These kind of epidemics do develop over time. There is always a risk that that can happen anywhere. But at the moment, they are operating essentially on a sustainable basis. Their growing capacity is not nearly what ours is per acre. They have much more severe climate conditions, and the soil conditions are not nearly as great as they are in Northwest Oregon.
Thank you. One other question, and again, this falls into the. I'm asking it because I simply have no idea what it is. Under the Forest Practices Act, or under these management plans, what sort of additives do you put on the ground for new timber or for growing timber? I'm thinking about things like fertilizer, pesticides, and things of that sort? And what sort of environmental issues do those pose?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, under management strategies on land that our company owns, typically we harvest the timber at anywhere from age 50 to 65 in that neighborhood. We have experimented with fertilization. That has not yet proven to be cost beneficial on these highly productive forest lands. To the extent competing vegetation is necessary to control, herbicides are used to control competing vegetation, again, in very low doses, much lower doses than what you would control dandelions in your front yard. But it's necessary to successfully regenerate a site in western Oregon without the use of prescribed burns, as an example, to use some degree of herbicide activity, again, in very low doses.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Other questions? Representative Verger.
Yes, my question is for Ray, and I just wonder, in your opinion, are the restrictive standards that are being used today by the state, by the department, brought on by former legislative processes, administrative rules, or by other agencies that are involved in natural resources? There must be some explanation for the restriction.
Representative Berger, I don't think so. The Board of Forestry spent a lot of time developing this management plan that it includes these strategies to have wider buffers and that sort of thing. Their statutory authority comes from the legislature in the chapter that this bill amends, and basically the legislature has ignored this chapter for a long time. These trees have been young and growing, and there hasn't been a commercial value, and so it's just been kind of benign neglect. Now we're to the point where they are mature and do have commercial value, and that's where this review, I think, is timely and appropriate to have the legislature say, well, how are we doing with these lands, and, you know, are we on the right track, wrong track, or does the Board of Forestry need a direction? But the direction they get and the basis for their plan is pretty much directly from the legislature through this particular law, and there's not other agencies.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, can I make one comment while
you
I have the floor? Getting back to Representative Barnhart's question on Swiss needle cats, the reason that is directly addressed in the bill is not because the Department of Forestry doesn't recognize the problem and the need to convert to disease-resistant species. They do. That's part of their plan. The reason it's in the bill is because their plan projects doing that relatively slowly, at least from our perspective, over a 20-year period. If that was privately owned, and private landlords, by the way, have the same problem with Swiss needle cats, and they're converting those stands as fast as they can, and there's no reason to do it slowly because it needs to be done to get the productivity back. So that's the reason that issue is specifically addressed in this bill.
Well, as long as we're on that topic, is there a reason, from the standpoint of disease control, to remove the diseased trees quickly or not?
Representative Barnhart, only for the reason to get the land back in a productive state. This disease doesn't kill the trees, it just stops the growth. So basically you've got an unproductive piece of land because it's not adding volume every year like it should be.
Well, I guess what I'm asking about is the method of infection and whether the fact that there's a diseased tree in the neighborhood endangers other trees.
I think, Representative Barnhart, I'm a little bit of thin ice here getting into science, but I think density is a factor. If you've got better spacing and a multi-species stand instead of a species with just one stand with just one species in it, that diminishes the impact of the disease.
Mr. Ivanoff, did you want to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think that if you were to ask the department's experts on this disease problem, they would say the jury's out in terms of stand density. Thinning may tend to exacerbate the transmission of the disease, but it seems to me that it would be logical to assume that if you eradicate the host species, that the ability to infect other Douglas firs more on the inland side of the range would be diminished. And certainly to the extent that there's a trust responsibility to the counties on the way these lands, there ought to be a strategy to get these lands producing in an environmentally sensitive manner as quickly as possible. And they're basically stagnating on a lot of that coastal fog belt.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Fass.
If, thank you. If we just, it, how much of this, those figures that you used, 179 or 100 million, how much of that is the Swiss needlecast disease freeze? I mean, if, say we only did that, how close does that get you to where your goal is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, the best way I could answer that, the Tillamook District encompasses about 250,000 acres, or about half of the three North Coast districts. I would suggest that about half of that land base is impacted on the Tillamook. Half of the Tillamook is impacted with Swiss needlecast. I'm not sure I could give you a real quick response. Of the total volume that the department sells, I can't say off the top of my head how much of it is needlecast infected timber. There has been an emphasis, and I will give the department credit. They have made a move to try to convert more of that. But the whole premise of Dr. Sessions' plan was that in addition to the conversion of the needlecast, there would be the same management intensities employed across the balance of the landscape that he assumed in the model. And that's where, in my view, there's a significant disconnect, and why harvest levels are dramatically lower is because the harvest activity on the rest of the landscape is not as intense as, or as active as Dr. Sessions modeled and that the board approved.
And that's it, what you're trying to get at in Section 2, primarily for timber production through harvest. Is that
yes.
The meat of what you just said?
Yes, sir.
That. One other question, back
yes.
to Mr. Chair.
Yes.
On the in Section 3, where the board may not allow or require more restrictive standards, are you talking about rules from the department? How can it do that?
Representative Hass, that section, the statute there, refers to the Forest Practices Act. That's what 527.610 is. So basically what that's saying is that the environmental protection standards that are applied on the state land should be the same as they're applied on or on private land should be the same. So that's basically what that section would do.
So that invites the inquiry, the question then, if those standards are insufficient, then they should be addressed
right.
for all forest landowners.
Absolutely.
And address them that way.
That's correct.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for a very enlightening panel. We'll
thank
ask you.
You
to stand down, stay in the room, don't go too far, but let's invite up our forestry folk. That'd be Janet McClellan, Steve Thomas, Ross Holloway, and Tim Josie. Come on up. Commissioner Josie, I think I may be the only one in this committee that served with you in this body. Okay, that's fine. Come on up.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, it's our pleasure to be here this morning and provide you with some information regarding this particular bill. We have a panel of people that try to give you an overview of where we are. Let me introduce myself.
Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry. I'm Steve Thomas, Assistant State Forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. And our panel will be Ross Holloway, who is the State Forest Program Director. And he will provide you with kind of our position on the bill and what we are doing in regards to the management of forest lands. Janet McClellan, former board chair and board member, provide you a little bit of a history and the context in which these lands are currently being managed based on what's gone on in the past and what the legislature and laws have said about the management of these forest lands. And then Tim Josie will come and give you his view as a Tillamook County Commissioner and also the Vice Chair of the Forest Trust Land Advisory Committee, and that particular committee advises both the board and the state forester on the management of state forest lands. So we'll go ahead and do that, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions you might have. So, Ross, did you want to start?
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Ross Holloway, and I'm the director of the State Forest Program for the Department of Forestry, and I was also the project leader for development of the forest management plans that we've been discussing. The Department of Forestry appreciates the opportunity to provide testimony on House Bill 3632 today. Department does oppose the bill in its current form for the reason of its far-reaching effects on the forest management plans recently developed and adopted by the Board of Forestry and now being implemented on 789,000 acres of state forests. As we interpret it, the bill as written would require revision of all the existing state forest management plans, all of which have been adopted through rigorous public review and input over a period of 10 years for the four forest management plans that we now have in place. And these would be the Eastern Region Plan for our lands in Klamath County, the Northwest Oregon Forest Management Plan, which we've talked about this morning, the Southwest Oregon Forest Management Plan, also referred to this morning, and portions of the Elliott State Forest Management Plan on the South Coast. The existing resource management mandate for state forests dates back over 70 years to the original legislation authorizing the board to manage state forest lands. And I won't elaborate on that history, as I think Janet McLennan will provide more detail on that in her testimony. So I'll pass over that. The bill, as written, would redefine greatest permanent value, which is the essence of the management mandate that we develop the forest management plans under, and therefore would result in processes to rewrite those existing forest management plans and the district implementation plans that flowed from those adopted plans. And while the bill specifically calls for the board to modify the Northwest Oregon State Forest Management Plan, by changing the definition of greatest permanent value, we would indeed have to amend or redo all those forest management plans. As well, the board would have to amend or repeal the existing administrative rule that defines greatest permanent value, a rule which also includes a lot of other direction for the management of the lands, not the least of which is the planning process that we need to go through to amend or revise a forest management plan. The bill would also result in two separate sets of management standards, or I should say could result in two separate sets of management standards for state forests under the jurisdiction of the Board of Forestry. It specifically states that the management standard for the Clatsop and Tillamook State Forests could not exceed the Forest Practices Act standards. While presumably standards for other state forest lands could still be at the discretion of the board.
I think we heard some testimony about at least potential amendment to broaden that to all state lands so we can get away from that two-tier kind of management approach.
And the provisions of the bill would not apply to the 132,000 acres of common school land, which is under the jurisdiction of the state land board. So that land is intermixed in many cases with Board of Forestry lands. So that leaves open the possibility of another set of standards adopted by the land board. And indeed, on the Elliott State Forest, there is a third and distinct set of standards in place under the land board's authority. Private landowners routinely apply standards that exceed the Forest Practices Act for a variety of resource management reasons, and this legislation would prohibit that flexibility on the Clatsop and Tillamook State Forest or the Allstate Forest if amended. The bill calls for rapid conversion of Swiss needle cast infected stands on the Clatsop and Tillamook State Forests while maintaining harvest levels in other portions of the forest. It's not totally clear what's contemplated by the term rapid, but we're currently applying Board of Forestry direction and converting those severely infected stands in a 20-year period, and I think that was already referred to. In developing the forest management plans and having the public discussion along the way, we really did try to steer clear of the either-or solution where you had to have either timber or other resource values and tried to find a balance of uses. And I think that was a balance that we struck with the beneficiaries working directly with us in terms of counties working with us on our steering committee, as well as the variety of publics that came to the table along the way, many of which are represented in the room today. So we chose to pursue a solution that would provide an optimum level of a variety of outputs rather than focusing on one particular output. All the time, though, having in mind the importance of the timber and revenue to the beneficiaries, that being the primary reason the lands were deeded to us to manage. We think the forest management plan the board adopted does hold great promise as a model for how public forests can be managed to provide an array of benefits. And I'd point out that the 3% acreage of state forest lands in this state are producing more timber and revenue today than all of the federal lands in the state combined. And that's not by accident. And our concern is that the bill before you today would diminish the 6 years of public planning we undertook for the Northwest Forest Management Plan and the 3 years of implementation planning that followed, and impose an approach that has not been collaboratively developed with all those stakeholders. So in summary, we believe the current forest management plan is a plan that will produce a balance of economic, environmental, and social values consistent with the ownership objectives of these lands and important to Oregonians. And we think it's a plan that deserves to be fully implemented and evaluated in contrast to other approaches being applied on forest lands in Oregon. So thank you for your opportunity to provide testimony. There were a lot of technical questions earlier that I'm glad to provide more information on if you desire. And we look forward to answering any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Why don't we go to Mr. Mel's testimony, and then we'll do questions. Who's next? Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, Chair Shetterly and members of the committee, my name is Janet McLennan, and I have been asked to appear to give you a little retrospective history of how these lands came into state ownership and the standards under which they have been managed and how the greatest permanent value rule derived from that history, really. In addition to being chair of the Board of Forestry between 1990 and 1995, I had earlier worked for the legislature, as a matter of fact, as staff director of the Natural Resource Committee in the 1973-74 interim, and subsequently I served as assistant to Governor Straub as his natural resource advisor, the history is long and torturous, really, and something you need to have some appreciation of to make some policy judgments about these lands and how they should be managed. The legislature first became concerned or addressed the concern of lands devolving to county ownership in 1931. At that time, some lands tended to be abandoned after being cut, and slowly an accumulation in county ownership was building up. That accumulation was tremendously increased by both Tillamook fires of 1933 and 39, and also was aggravated by the Depression, where people were frequently abandoning their lands to the counties and being foreclosed against by reason of hardship as well as fire. By the late 1930s, 1.4 million acres of formerly private land had devolved into county ownership. That's about 15% of the forest land in Oregon. In 1939, under the leadership of Governor Sprague, legislation was passed that provided a really a viable and attractive option for the counties. They were then authorized to deed the lands in exchange for the promise of future revenue. And approximately 640,000 acres of land, which had been private and then was in county ownership, moved to state ownership during the 1940s and 50s and 60s. Over these decades, the legislature and the Board of Forestry from time to time have spoken about which land should be acquired, were authorized to be acquired, and how they should be managed. The 1931 legislation authorized the board to manage state forest lands for continuous forest production and to promote sustained yield forest management, for water conservation and watershed protection, and for recreation. The 1939 legislation authorized acquisition chiefly for the production of forest crops, watershed protection and development, erosion control, grazing, recreation, and forest administration. In 1941, the legislature made a significant amendment to the Acquisition Act, stating that state forests were resources of statewide concern And that legislature directed the board to manage the land so as to secure the greatest permanent value of such lands to the state. policy statements reflecting multiple use continue to evolve. The 1967 legislature continued that mandate about maintaining and securing the greatest permanent value, but it amended the section governing uses to make it inclusive, and it specifically added forage and browse for domestic livestock, fish and wildlife environment, landscape effect, protection against floods and erosion, and protection of water supplies. And it qualified those as being permitted when, in the opinion of the board, such use is not detrimental to the best interests of the state. During the 1970s, the board, reacting in part to allegations of industry domination, reinforced its policy with respect to multiple use. The concern about the composition of the board resulted in the legislature's reconstituting the Board of Forestry in 1987. It had been a large, what I would call, portfolio board. That is, the members represented specific interests, and most of them represented particular industry associations. The 87 legislation changed that composition to a seven-person board, and one which was directed by statute to represent the public interest, all members to represent the public interest, though three were permitted to derive some proportion of their revenue, of their income, from the forest products industry. It was then in 1987 that I was appointed to the board, along with six others. And this public interest standard tended to guide our deliberations and was frequently alluded to as we considered some of these issues. The Board of Forestry is directed by the statute to develop a forest policy for the state, and this had found expression first in 1976. In something called the Forestry Program for Oregon. The first two forestry programs for Oregon, the one in 76 and the one in 83, dealt almost exclusively with the issue of timber supply. The so-called then new Board of Forestry, the 87 Board, expanded this policy and the goals of forest policy in Oregon to include among other things, the preservation of forest land base, forest practices regulation, encouragement of fish and wildlife, recreation, scenic values, and other forest uses, urban forestry, public involvement, and public education in its first forest policy, FPFO, or Forestry Program for Oregon, in 1990. And when that policy document was amended in 1995, it went on further to expand those goals to include sustainable ecosystems and the maintenance of biological diversity in all the forests of the state, while at the same time supporting sustainable economics and communities. That thinking also influenced how the board addressed the management of state forests. And in those years, we adopted a policy calling for sustainable management of state forests and another governing exchanges and acquisitions. As has been indicated, in the early 90s, the efforts began on the development of new forest management plans. A couple of circumstances at that time dictated that all these planning efforts both the policy content and the processes would require rulemaking. In the first place, in 1993 and 1994, a conflict had arisen over a timber sale in the Cascade Foothills. And in a subsequent dispute resolution mediation, the department had agreed to enter into rulemaking on long-range planning and also on defining the phrase, the greatest permanent value. So we were under a court-approved agreement to undertake the rulemaking from that point on. In addition, in 1995, a number of the counties had been expressing concerns of a variety of kinds about state forest management and relative to revenues. And in addition, the 1995 sessions saw bills introduced at the request of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, which would have assigned revenue from the Tillamook State Forest to the Common School Fund. No bills were passed in 1995, but the legislature added a budget note directing forestry to work with the trust land counties to examine how to increase the predictability, stability, and certainty of revenues to counties and local taxing districts. And to accomplish that task, a task force was appointed and charged to develop a policy statement defining the purpose of the lands and the relationship between the state and the counties. Efforts at that time, and our efforts, were concentrated on developing what would be a legally defensible draft interpretive rule to evidence that understanding of the counties in transferring those lands and the state in receiving the lands, and to describe the continuing relationship as well as to interpret the statutory language and reflect the applicable judicial decision, which is known as the Crabtree decision, which we need not get into today, but
thank you.
But does affect all this. Originally, a series of rules was contemplated: the purpose of the lands draft, and a separate planning rule, and one governing forest land classification. Subsequently, these efforts, together with the earlier adopted sustainability rule, were rolled together as the greatest permanent value rule, and which was adopted in the year 2000. Really, as you can tell, about 5 years after we began. And pursuant to that rule, the Northwest Oregon Forest Plan, work on which had begun back in 1993 or 1994, was finally adopted in the year 2001. So, as you can see, Oregonians have been worrying about these lands for a long time, nearly three quarters of a century. And dealing with these issues has involved a great number of people. It's reflected a variety of historical circumstances, a growing body of scientific knowledge, and constantly involving thought process on how best to weave multiple use and the county's protected, recognizable interest in the land. The culmination of the board's current thinking in the context of the history of these lands is expressed in the greatest permanent value rule. That rule guides the management, and it balances economic, social, and environmental values that the legislature and governors and state foresters and county commissioners and the public generally have striven to achieve over these years. Unfortunately, I don't feel that House Bill 3632 achieves that same balance. Thank you very much. Well, I'll answer any questions you may
thank
have.
Thank you. We'll come back to you after we hear from Commissioner Josie, and then we'll have questions for the panel. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it didn't seem that long ago that I was on the Revenue Committee and sitting on that side of the panel, and I can guarantee it's much more comfortable being on your side. And you're right. You're the one member that served when I was here. However, Representative Hass was a reporter at the time, and so I did meet him. And actually, one time he and I were jogging at the same time, and I would just completing.
I thought he was chasing you.
Yeah. Now let me tell you something. This guy has long legs, and he's a fast jogger, and he just damn near killed me. But we got a lot of politics discussed during that half a mile or an hour mile that he and I jogged. Together, I quit and he kept on going. And of course, I know Representative Hobson. I was not asked by the Department of Forestry to testify today. In fact, I didn't know whether I would be testifying today up until, I think this weekend I finally decided that I should. This is not an easy issue for me because Tillamook County desperately needs jobs. And, our economy, I don't think, has really been hurt like the Willamette Valley during this recession. And the reason why is because we've just been sort of down at the bottom of the barrel all along. And so our economy hasn't really gotten any worse. I remember there was a time when there were five mills, and now we have one, two, three, and maybe four mills. And just a mere shadow of what it used to be. And so in terms of jobs and in terms of the revenues that these trust lands bring to the county, boy, I tell you, it's tough for me to come to you and testify against House Bill 3632. But I've spent a lot of time working with the department since becoming a county commissioner, working on the development of the forest management plan, and I think that it is a responsible plan for a number of different reasons. First of all, let me tell you, got word this morning from Clatsop County. Clatsop County holds 30%, roughly 30% of the forest trust lands. Tillamook County holds 50% of the trust lands. Between the two of us, you do the math, we're the 800-pound gorillas. In terms of the trust counties, we represent by far the most land. And the Clatsop, I'll read the message that was sent today. This is the Clatsop County Board of Commissioners opposes 3632. This bill would increase the harvest level to that of a tree farm and I can't read my writing. The balance of the and destroy the balance of the forest management plan that are created by the forest management plan. And then also I need to also tell you about the Council of Forest Trust Land Counties, that's CFTLC. There's FTLAC, which is an advisory board to the Board of Forestry and the State Forester, and then CFTLC, which is the Council of Forest Trust Land Counties. They're virtually the same group of people. I'm the vice chair of both, but serves different roles. In one role, we serve as a legal entity, a public entity of the trust counties. The CFTLAC Board of Directors at their last meeting, which was a conference call held on May the 2nd, the majority of the board decided not to take action to seek a legislative change to either the state forest management policy or the state forest management plan. We did so for the following reasons. We're working with the Oregon Department of Forestry to resolve our differences. You heard from Dave Ivanhoff we adopted Alternative 1C2. In fact, in my testimony, if you've got it before you, it's a graph that I'll refer to later. We thought that we had agreed upon initially 279 million board feet, and then lo and behold, it was 149, and we've got it up to about 175 million board feet for the three Northwest districts. We don't think that's good enough. And so we've hired Mark Rasmussen, Mason Bruce, and Gerard. He's on our retainer. He's working with the department. We have a plan in place, and he, as I said, it's an agreed upon plan that the trust counties and the department have adopted that actually goes out and reassess the forest lands, the lands that are out there, at what the size of the trees and, you know, how many board feeds are, is out there. And then once that's done, we're going to run another model. So we're going to let the chips fall where they may. The reason why the numbers are less is because, from my understanding, Dr. John Sessions did not understand the impact of the Swiss needle cast. As was testified earlier, these trees aren't growing. And he assumed the computer model assumed a growth rate of so much a year, and as stated earlier, that isn't happening. So that's one of the reasons why the numbers are lower. So we're working, the trust counties are committed to work with the department, and I believe the department is committed to work with us to resolve these differences. And then we also need to demonstrate that the trust counties can and will work with the integrated structure-based management approach. Now I would like to speak for myself. I've spent, ever since becoming a county commissioner, I've spent a lot of time working with this issue, and I've also spent a lot of time with the Board of Forestry. Now, the Board of Forestry, there's been a turnover, but it has always struck me that the Board of Forestry is a very intelligent, sincere, diverse group of people that have spent literally thousands and thousands of hours working on this plan, as I have. And I got started working on this plan, working as an advisory member. There are two county commissioners that met monthly with the department personnel, and we hammered through the forest management plan, and it was a huge learning curve for me. And I can tell you, there's a lot that I don't know. But over that time, I got a chance to know the folks in the Department of Forestry, the personnel, and they really do care about the environment. Some of them didn't like the forest management plan. Most of them were willing to give it a shot. The vast majority of them were willing to give it a shot because they believed that what they were building was a license to manage these forest lands. And so I won't go into talking about the forest management, about all the values. I think you know what they are. It's a number of values built into this plan that that an older forest structure emulates. And at its core, with structure-based management, at its core is a design to emulate an older forest system so that we can emulate an older forest system in about 60 to 70 years. If we take the current stand of timber and leave it alone or create a preserve, which some of the folks in the Willamette Valley want to do. Senate Bill 430 takes 50% of that and sets it aside. It also modifies the purpose of the land rule, which basically means that 100% of the land would be set aside. I know that because I've spent time working on the plan and the purpose of the lands rule. If we set these lands aside, as many people want, it's going to take 200 to 300 years for the forest to right itself and create an older forest system if disease or forest fire doesn't get at it first. And so when Senate Bill 430 was here on the other side, I came and testified against that bill. And if I had the guts to testify against that bill, I certainly should have the guts to testify against this one. They're both bookend bills. And neither one of these bills serve this land well. These lands are not private forest lands. The Forest Practices Act does a very good job protecting private forest lands environmentally. These lands are public, and they need to be held to a higher standard. Now, what this bill does is it takes the hundreds and hundreds of hours that the trust counties and the Board of Forestry and the department and the community, scientific community from all walks of life and from all across the nation looking at our critically reviewing this forest management plan. It takes all of that work and sets it aside. And you folks come in and dictate what forest policy should be. You take this role away from the Department of Forestry. If you take this away from the Department of Forestry and politicize this, the question I ask you is, what's going to happen in 2 years from now, or 4 years from now, or 6 years from now when the political climate changes? You set the precedent. It can it can be anywhere on the map. And I can tell you what happened with our federal forest lands. It went from about 4 billion board feet a year nationally to zero, almost zero. Rural Oregon lost 60,000 jobs in the 1990s because of political decisions in Congress. Half of those jobs are gone forever. The other 30,000 jobs, half of them are in the service sector, earning low-wage jobs. That's the precedent that you're setting. You don't, once you open up this can of worms and you take over the role of the Board of Forestry, you don't know what's going to happen. So you're playing high-stakes poker with the people in Tillamook County. We received last year $2.9 million in forest revenues. And we also have one of the lowest property tax rates in the state. And it's locked in place now because of Measure 47. It's low because of our timber revenues. We desperately need those revenues. We need more revenues. And to that extent, let me to refer you to the Dr. Sessions model. Now, we know that this is not correct, but generally speaking, we know that what we can expect. Now, this is over decades, so this is 200 years. The reason why I show you this is because the forest management plan is brand new, it's in its infancy, and we're just getting started. Give the plan a chance. This land is now coming online. Everybody wants it. The environmental community would like to close it down, and now the private timber industry would like to create a private tree farm. Both of those are wrong. Let the forest management plan work. It's a long plan. It has at its core adaptive management. So I plead with you, don't kill us with love. We can't afford it. Thank you.
All right, questions for this panel? Representative Hess.
Thank you, Commissioner Josie. I do remember going running with you. I think I remember you encouraging me to run for the legislature, and I've never forgiven you for that. So. You were talking about the trust commissions. Is that the same as the County Forest Land Commission, or is that different, or what's the status of that?
I can get really confused with the acronyms. This FTA, the Forest Trust Lands Advisory Committee, was created statutorily. And it meets. In fact, we're going to be meeting on Friday. And our staff is the Department of Forestry. You know, they take minutes and help us with the agenda and that sort of thing. And so it's sort of a report. They report to us once a month on a number of different subjects, and we give our input to them. And then we also give our input to the Board of Forestry. So legally, we're advisory to the Board of Forestry and to the state forester. And then the council is exactly the same group of people, but we're sort of an offshoot of the Association of Oregon Counties. We work through them. In fact, Gil Rydell, who works with the Association of Oregon Counties, he's our staff person, and we're a legal entity, and we need to advertise for public meeting law purposes and that sort of thing.
If I could just...
Yeah.
What, with respect to the Swiss needle cast, I understand what you said, and I appreciate what you said, but what about stepping up the harvest for those trees?
Well, we are stepping up the harvest. I wish I had Mark Labhart, the district forester, here, and he will tell you that there are a lot of acres that are being harvested, and you can only do so much at a time. The thing you got to remember, the folks in the Willamette Valley, when they drive to the coast, they either take Highway 26 or Highway 6. And I can already tell you what it looks like when they go out and take the infected Swiss needle cast out. Yeah, I mean, it looks an awful lot like a clear cut. And you can only take so much out at a time. Not only that, if you look at, I don't have the harvest acres, maybe you could talk to that, but they really are stepping up and I think dealing with it in a responsible way. And if Mr. Ross could handle this.
Mr. Chair and Representative Haas, some numbers. The original implementation plans that we envisioned prior to becoming fully aware of the extent of Swiss needle cast envisioned about 1,000 acres of clear cut per year on the Tillamook State Forest in the initial phases of implementation, combined with 4,000 to 5,000 acres of thinning or partial cutting in those young stands, which we believed to be relatively healthy at the time. Now, this is 6 or 7 years ago. The current implementation plan proposes approximately 5,000 acres a year of clear cutting to address conversion of severely infected Swiss needle cast. At that pace, we believe it'll take 10 to 20 years to convert all the severely infected stands. And that picture has shifted yearly as we've done the annual surveys. The severity has waxed and waned, but is relatively stable in terms of the overall amount of the zone infected. The thinning has dropped. We've dropped the thinning down to about 1,000 to 1,500 acres a year, and the reason for that is in those moderately and lightly infected stands, there's a significant question about the effects of thinning on stand growth in Swiss needle cast, and we have a large-scale research project that was initiated almost 2 years ago now that OSU is conducting, and we're just starting to get the results of that in. What are the effects of thinning different densities in these stands? And hopefully those results will allow us to make some better choices about this pool of stands, or there's a real question mark. Converting them all over to alternate species is not without great cost. And if they will respond to the thing and grow well, that's a better option. So there's a big pool of stands that are uncertain right now. And hopefully in the next 2 to 3 years, those will be able to move those out. It's either say convert them or continue to thin them and manage them. And that research is just now producing information to us. So.
Representative Bernhardt.
It's a follow-up, really. What percentage of the forest is seriously infected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernhardt, that number shifts from year to year as we do the surveys, and they're done in the spring, and depending on the climatic conditions and the weather conditions, you get a little different results. But in the neighborhood of 80,000 acres in the Tillamook district, which was really the epicenter and the main focus,
percentage-wise,
that's about a third of the district. You're in this zone where we see severe symptoms. Specific stands, you really don't know until you go in on the ground and look at them, and it's evaluated based on needle retention. Douglas fir normally retains 5 to 6 years worth of needles. Severely infected stands are stands that have 2 to 3 years or less needle retention. So
this is a big deal, isn't it?
It is a big deal, no doubt about that. It's a major disease problem, and we believe we're aggressively treating it. But again, with some measure, some measure of conservatism, just due to the uncertainties that we hope the research will shed some light on.
Representative Berger.
Yes, I'm from southwestern Oregon, and even though this doesn't actually have anything to do with the forest there, it's my understanding that we have very little of the disease. Is that true of the Swiss needle cast?
Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, that is true, particularly in the interior zone. Swiss needle casts at this point are largely confined to the coastal strip, and the severe symptoms are in the really what we call the fog belt, that first 8 to 10 miles, which was traditionally western hemlock, Sitka spruce zone. In Coos County, in the county forest lands along the coast and some of the Elliott State Forest, we do have Swiss needle cast. It's not as severe as we're seeing on the north coast, but it is increasing in severity, or it appears to have increased in severity in the survey years we've done recently.
A follow-up,
yes. Please.
There is a vast amount of criticism of the management of Elliott State Forest as well, and I'm sure you're familiar with that. And from time to time, in fact, they've had to try to perhaps change the management there to a tribal management or some other entity. I wonder if you are working, as the county commissioner has suggested they are, if you're working with people from my area in trying to get things perhaps more harmonious.
Well, Chair Shetterly and Representative Berger, we do currently have an amendment process or an update process in place for the Elliott State Forest Management Plan. As I'm sure you're aware, the Elliott State Forest is primarily common school land under the jurisdiction of the State Land Board. So the counties and local taxing districts don't derive direct revenue benefits from it. Rather, they derive the benefits through the distribution of the earnings on the common school fund. The Elliott State Forest Management Plan was adopted in 1993, and then the Habitat Conservation Plan was approved by the Land Board in 1995 for northern spotted owls and marbled merlets. And that really is the crux of the issue on the Elliott, is endangered species. Because of the age of that forest, it was essentially chock full of owls and merlets when the federal ESA listings occurred. And harvest levels dropped to about 5 million board feet per year from what had been 50 million board feet per year. And under the provisions of the Habitat Conservation Plan, returned to about 27 million board feet a year, which is what we've maintained now since the mid-1990s under that HCP. So we're in the process of revising and updating that plan in HCP in the hopes to continue that on the Elliott. And there's a public process in place that's, we have John Griffith from Coos County on our steering committee for that effort. And Tim is working with us on some of the Habitat Conservation Plan issues as well.
Like a Senate document, that Pickin was expected to read it, and that's printed on both sides.
You didn't?
This is what these folks send me.
Yeah. Okay. Just a couple of comments, and then we need to finish up. We've got 4 or 10:45 and several witnesses yet to hear, but I think we've heard from the chief proponents and opponents in the exposition. That's been very helpful. One thing I've heard, I guess, in sort of a theme of the testimony from all three of you has been this sense that, you know, this is, it's not unreasonable, but the sense that this is policy developed by the Department of Forestry and the legislature treads on agency jurisdiction. It should give strong deference to the agency, and I agree with that. By the same token, I think from the history that Ms. McClellan, you gave us, this wouldn't be the first time the legislature has waded in directing policy to the board of or to the Department of Forestry, and I think Mr. Holloway, you talked about the last, was it 6 to 10 years, I guess, in developing the management plan, and I would say that's probably corresponded to the period of time that, going back to Mr. Wilkinson's testimony, he said described as benign neglect on the part of the legislature. And I think, you know, if you look at the 90s, our focus was on what? High tech. It was on manufacturers, on the new economy, and it was easy for us, I think, to treat slightly the some of the natural resource based industry that we've had in this state. But I'm not surprised, Frank, if you look at it in terms of where we are in the economy and jobs today, that this would be an area of renewed interest on the part of the legislature. So I don't think it's necessarily a criticism of the work that you've done. I think it has been something where the legislature just has been otherwise focused for the past 10 years. And now where we are in terms of jobs and in terms of state revenues, to look at the prospect of converting a resource that we have to something that, while maintaining compliance with the Forest Practices Act and all environmental laws, gives us the opportunity to increase state revenues through forest management by $90 million directly and $3,600 jobs and all the revenues that come in with that. It's hard for us not to want to take a look at that. And again, I don't think it's a reflection of the work that you've done so much as it is of the time and one of those historical moments that you referred to when the legislature sort of gets interested again directly in forest management policy, for better or for worse. But that's where we are. Let me just leave it at that, and let's bring up our other witnesses. I want to try and make sure we get everybody heard today. I've got from out of town, Tina Swanson. I think you came up from Glendale. Yeah. And let's bring up Rob Freres and Kirk Harrison. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'll let you decide who goes first. Just identify yourselves, please, and then have at us.
I'll go first. Okay. My name's Rob Freres, and I'm with Freres Lumber Company, and we're located east of here, about 25 miles in Lyons and in Mill City in Linn County. Our family business was established in 1922. In 1980, we had about 100 employees, and today we have about 450. We don't own much timberland. We had 4,000 acres in 1990, and we have about 15,000 now, which doesn't sustain our mills. It provides maybe 7 to 10% of what we need. And so we've been government contractors since the Second World War. we've relied almost exclusively on the state and the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service for our timberland, our timber supply. And as the federal forest harvests have been reduced to almost zero, we have come to rely even more greatly on state timber harvests. And presently, we're a top five purchaser of state timberland, timber sales. And this bill before you would be of great benefit to us if harvests were increased. And we used to use 95-98% public timber. Today our mix is maybe 35%, and we could easily switch, and we would prefer to buy state of Oregon timber. It's of higher quality. It meets what our customers want, and it makes the products that we're trying to make in a more efficient and effective manner. We can recover more out of state timber than we can a lot of open market logs that we buy. We've added 100 people to our payroll in the last year. We bought a bankrupt plywood mill in 1998, and over the past 5 years have spent between $5 and $6 million improving it, and now it's a really nice plant, and that's where we've added people in our green veneer plants to increase our veneer manufacturing, our veneer drying, and our plywood manufacturing. And this bill that we strongly endorse, we think that the department does a wonderful job, but they're just being overly conservative and in the management of their lands, and we can safely and environmentally consciously increase the harvests and return some revenue to the general fund. We're at a very low price for our finished products today, and I think it was a week or so ago, we paid $431 per 1,000 board feet for the last timber sale that we bought from the state. So it's much higher than the $300 average that you're using. So all the way through, I think conservatism has been the norm in the figures that you've received today, and I think that you would see a far more bang for the buck than you're estimating so far.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Harrison?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kirk Harrison. I represent RSG Forest Products. I buy logs and manage timber for the company. RSG owns three Oregon sawmills, directly employing 419 workers in Oregon. Our MIST facility depends on 50% of its raw materials, and Molalla and Estacada facilities depend on 10 to 20% of their log supply from either our own ODF timber sales or logs purchased from other timber sale purchasers. Our two mills located in Kalama, Washington, that employ another 243 workers are also indirectly affected by ODF timber availability because shrinking supply of timber could cause our mills to compete with each other for logs, potentially causing shutdowns and layoffs. We believe any bill ensuring that timber production be an ODF priority will help to keep mills running, employees working, and the economy going. I wanted to add a little bit to Dave Ivanoff had mentioned the management style that's being employed in Northwest Oregon, where partial cutting of stands, trying to make a lot of old growth type stands remaining. And that puts us at a big disadvantage because we have a limited size at all our mills of 32 inches maximum log size that we can utilize in our mills. So as these stands grow, get bigger and older, it becomes stuff that we can't use anymore.
Well, I was going to ask about that. Hasn't that been the trend across the industry to go towards smaller mills?
Small. So yeah.
Are we growing ourselves out of capacity to mill these?
That's correct. In fact, I only know of one mill in that whole area of northwestern Oregon that can actually handle logs bigger than we can at this time. So,
well, see, then we'll add new mills.
We purchased logs in the Forest Grove district and we have purchased in the Tillamook district in the past, and about 2 years ago we put $4 million into a large log plant that can take logs 60 inches or larger. So there is a home for them.
Yeah, but clearly the trend has been towards the smaller.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Ms. Swanson.
Yes. Thank you very much, Chair Shetterly, and the rest of the representatives for letting me speak here today. My name is Tina Swanson, and I not only work for the Swanson Group, but I'm also here representing all the employees as well as the family that owns the Swanson Group. The Swanson Group was originally founded in 1951 by my father and his brother, my uncle, and they've been in business for over 50 years now in the town of Glendale, Oregon, which is about 20 miles north of Grants Pass, a very small town.
We know Glendale.
Oh, do you? In 1973, my brothers, along with one of their other brothers, founded Swanson Superior Forest Products, which is in Notai, Oregon, which is west of Eugene. And that was a unique mill at the time because it was a small log sawmill, which was a little unusual at that time. And since then, we've retooled all of our facilities to be small log sawmills. And speaking about the diameters, both of our sawmills can only use up to a 15-inch log, actually. We can run a larger log at our stud facility. We've also purchased Gregory Forest Products, which was also in Glendale, and that was a veneer and a plywood plant. In 1996, we founded Superior Helicopter, LLC, and in 2001, we acquired another family-owned company, which was Sun Studs in Roseburg, Oregon. So today, we manufacture dimensional lumber, 2x4, 2x6, primarily for construction needs in California, for roof trusses and floor trusses, as well as studs that get sold primarily to the Arizona and California markets, as well as plywood materials. We've taken a leadership role in ensuring the total and efficient use of all our forest resources. Every portion of the log is used, whether it be sold to other facilities or used in our own facilities for steam generation to run our kilns or our plywood facilities. The company has obviously grown since its inception. When the mill first began operating in 1951, my dad told me last night we had 21 employees. And today we operate with over 600 employees. And the majority of those employees all live in rural Oregon. 400 of those employees live in the Glendale-Azalea region. That doesn't even include the employees that we have that live in Grants Pass. So as you can see, that's very rural Oregon. That 600 employees that we have does not include all of the contractors that we have that log our lands, that haul the logs to our mills. Doesn't include those people that haul chips and byproducts from our mills, nor does it include all the crews that we have to reforest our lands after we harvest. One of the things that makes me the most proud as both an employee and a family member is that we are able to provide a living wage job for those people that work at our facilities. We have jobs wages that are far above what the minimum wage is. Many of the positions start $11 or $12 an hour, which is by far more what you can obtain in the service sector, particularly if you don't have a college education or something like that. In the 1980s, it became apparent to the Swanson Group that we needed to obtain some of our own forest lands. So unlike these two gentlemen's companies, we do own some of our own forest lands. We own 140,000 acres that we actively and intensively manage for our mills. We practice sustained forest practices, and it is our rule of thumb to meet or exceed the Oregon Forest Practices Act, and that demonstrates our commitment to the future, I believe. We plant over 1 million seedlings every year on our own properties. Currently, our log usage, we obtain only about 1/3 of our log usage from our own property. So the other 2/3 have to come from outside sources. One of those could be open market purchases, which could be timber sales that Weyerhaeuser would put up down to a small woodland owner bringing in one load of logs. And then the other 1/3 of what we get typically comes from government contracts, being federal or state lands. And I feel that we can manage our forests for many different uses, and in actively managing our public lands, we can not only create timber for harvest, but improve the health and viability of our forests. And increasing the levels off of state lands and making that a priority is a true win-win situation, I believe. It will provide money for the state, build homes for families, and provide true living wages for people like those that work for my company. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? All right. We'll move on. Thank you very much for coming in and testifying today. Let's bring up a couple county commissioners, a couple more, Paul Hanneman and Mike Propes.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Hope to be fairly brief this morning. Paul Hanneman, Tillamook County, for the record, live at Cloverdale, Oregon. By way of background, I did serve in the legislature for 26 years. I didn't have either the fortune or misfortune of serving on the House Revenue Committee at any time during those years, and I always thought that I did escape at least the obligation and the challenges that the House Revenue Committee has to face over the years. Served almost 20 years on the e-board and Ways and Means on that side. And I did chair the House Natural Resources Committee in 1971 when we passed the first Forest Practices Act. At that time, as I recall, it was the first one in the nation. I'm here this morning, Ms. Chair and members, to support 3632, and I think that it's one of the five most important bills, or one of the most important bills that you'll have during the whole session. That's my viewpoint, because it really sustains jobs, and I'm not going as far as to say that it will create jobs in Oregon, but what we're trying to do on the Northwest Oregon coast is sustain our mill jobs, and this bill will help do it. And I think it fits well with the governor's Grow Oregon program, and should be supported there. It gives meaning and restores faith and direction to 50 years of trust agreements and court decisions. And I don't think it violates those. I think that it augments those. And it abides by the visions of so many people that worked so hard to build one of the world's greatest man-made forests. Helps to augment the Department of Forestry's budget. If I was still on Ways and Means and this bill was in revenue, I would hope that it came to Ways and Means to help us with the department's budget. Must be just a little chagrin on the part of the Department of Forestry to sit here and oppose a bill that is going to help prevent forest fires in this state and to carry on the management of our state forests. And it doesn't raise taxes. I commend this committee for introducing this bill as a committee bill. Most of your deliberations, I'm sure, include bills that do increase taxes. This one utilizes natural resources that we've spent 50 years getting here and doesn't raise taxes. And my last point, Ms. Chair and members, is that it retains the original basics of the department's forest management plan. I think you heard some testimony this morning that indicated that it disturbed the forest management plan that's been in the works for the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. And I believe that's not true. The objection is, on the part of some of us, is the implementation plans, at least one or two of those. Now, you take one of those implementation plans just adopted here in the last few months and take 151,000 of our 350,000 acres in Tillamook County and set those aside in a special implementation plan, which is a subsequent part of the forest management plan, and you start to erode and concern and jeopardize the jobs that we have in our mills and the guys that run chainsaws and all the people who drive the trucks and everybody else. That's what I think is at issue here, and not the fear that the forest management plan itself, which has been worked on for so long, is in jeopardy. I think that's not the case. And so I want to thank you for your attention. Again, thank you for introducing the bill as a committee bill. This is in the interest of the people of Oregon. The bill does not disturb fish and wildlife habitats, good water quality, recreation, but there has to be harvest too, and the bill does redirect the department without disturbing the management plan. And so, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hanneman. Commissioner Probst. Good morning, Mike.
Thank you, Chairman, committee members. Yes, also I've been asked to speak for the other Tillamook County Commissioner that couldn't be here this morning, just to pass on his support of this bill, just so you know that a quorum of the Tillamook County Commissioners does support this bill, which is the largest county that would be affected in this state. The committee will be, I assume, receiving a letter to that effect. There was some testimony earlier, you know, about the impacts, and I wasn't actually going to testify as my role as the chair of the County Forest Trust Lands. I am the chair of that committee, but since there was some testimony come in earlier from the County Forest Trust Lands, I guess I better clear that up. The County Forest Trust Lands have not taken a position on this bill. The only positions the County Forest Trust Lands have taken is a defensive mode to protect our formula. This bill does not affect the formula as far as how we receive monies, and that is the only position that we have taken as the committees. The two different committees that the counties are affected. So I just wanted to clear that up for this committee. Now, as my one more, I will have a little bit from Coos County also, from Polk County Commissioner. I've been very involved in negotiations on the county with the forest management plan ever since it started. I've been at the table, and I understand this, I think, the same as Dave Ivanoff when he said that this bill, the forest management plan, could be implemented under this bill. I read it the same way, that it could be implemented under this bill, that the Forest Management Practice Act doesn't interfere with that. There are certainly the implementation plan that they adopted is not acceptable. The counties have never agreed with the implementation plan that the department implemented, or the salmon habitat anchors. The Board of Forestry and the department had implemented a plan that the counties have not accepted to date. When we sat down and negotiated and worked with the department on a forest management plan, we were very pleased with it. It produced 297 million board feet of timber, approximately, and even though we knew at that time the lands would produce somewhere in the neighborhood of 350 million board feet a year, we felt that was a compromise. The environmental groups were at the table, the industry was at the table, and other various groups. We were willing at that time to give up something because of a compromise. Well, the first ones to leave the table were some environmental groups that agreed to that plan, and started threatening at that time to go to the ballot box and overturn the plan. And then the next one that appeared to leave the table was the department. They came up with an implementation plan that was 145 million board feet. And then the next thing was a salmon anchor habitat that was not part of what we'd agreed to. So what it appears that we need something like this from the legislation to protect the counties. The legislature has got involved in the past, but if you look at legislative history, and when the lands were turned over from the counties, there was a expectation all along from counties that there would be a good revenue source from these lands when they become mature. Well, they finally become mature. This is not the time we want to start giving up what we expected out of them. And you take particularly Tillamook, the direct revenues they receive when the lands are harvested, they've been sitting as a very poor county for a long time, waiting for these lands to become mature and get those revenue receipts. You take a county like ours, give you a little history. Wilhelmina, Grand Round, and Sheridan used to be the number one timber producing in the world. Not in Oregon, but in the world. We produced more timber and more jobs than anywhere in the world out of those three communities. Right now, we're just very, very struggling along. There's a few mills left. Those few mills that are left are dependent on state timber. We don't want to lose that that's left. Well, at the same time, we used to be the bottom of the scale for tourist industry. We had the fewest tourist industry jobs in the state, in Polk County. Today we're number one. That's because of the casino. We went from the bottom to the top. But what happened is those people used to have very high-paying jobs working in those mills, and it was one person in the family working while the other was home taking care of their kids. And we had very few problems in the families because of that. Now both people have to work because it takes, in the tourist industry, it takes both people working to make the house payments and raise the kids. You see a lot more problems in the families now because of the type of jobs we have to provide. So when we lost those high-paying industry jobs and went to the tourist jobs, the problems that are created in the community because of having both parents having to work, we don't want to lose these additional jobs out of the timber industry if we don't have these harvests and stuff in the state forests that we've been dependent on. Plus, the Tillamook Forest was planted by the counties. Those trees that are growing out there, the counties are paying for all that timber that was planted there. Tillamook's still paying the bill. You send your check every month, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Good. Don't quit sending it. So there's a lot that's involved here besides what you just hear in this. The other issue, since I've been involved in it, negotiations have been going on, and it's been, you know, usually in your negotiations, they go like this, and you get to a point here. Well, we feel like the negotiations, the counties have been here, and you start like this, and we've been going like this. And we're hoping we're going to catch them someday. Because, literally, we thought that we were here at, we had 350 million board feet volume, and, you know, the other groups were here, and that we got to 279, we thought we had an agreement. Well, then it came to 245. Okay. So we literally are chasing them in negotiations.
Mike, that's a very bad sign.
Yeah, I've seen that sign, and it's always when I'm talking it happens.
Tell you what, I am very, very much apologize to. I hope we got everybody who traveled a long ways here. Paul, let's reset this for Thursday. We've got a call of the House, and then we've got another one I know immediately following that, so we've only been excused for another 2 minutes, and it looks like Tom is here to ring us in. I want
Mr.
to apologize.
Could I just say thank you to Mike Groves? Polk County does not receive very much from timber revenues, a very, very small amount. Yet as chair of the committee, he's helped all of our counties, some of us who receive a great deal. And we owe him a lot of a debt of gratitude for his years of work there.
Mike, if you want to come back on Thursday, we can pick up with you. And also I want to acknowledge we got Bill Cluding. Bill, sorry, you live in Dallas. You can get here easy enough. We'll do you Thursday. Jim Geisinger from Associate Oregon Loggers, we want to hear from you. Ralph Saperstein, you're always around anyway. Chuck Bennett, no sweat. Jason Miner, Oregon Trout, I apologize. Which one is Jason? Jason, can you come back on Thursday? Okay, very good. We will conclude the testimony then on Thursday. We want to make sure we hear from everybody who wanted to testify. Sorry, everybody.
What happens to the other House?
Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3632. We'll put that up on Thursday as well. We'll put up House Bill 2747 on Thursday. We're adjourned. We'll be here.